Session number 20094, reel 13.
That's the reel 13.
So he came into the cavern, he put his hand on the end there, nearly burnt it. He said, "You're right." He said, "Switch off." He went up and phoned up the docks at Plymouth.
Spoke to a fellow officer, a stores officer at the dockyard, to find out if a similar motor or replacement alternator was available. As you know, dockyards usually shut down on a Friday night. This was a Saturday morning. However, he's rather persuasive in his speech and managed to find out, A, there was a replacement alternator available in Devonport Dockyard. B, he would have someone there available to issue it and take the other one in on exchange basis. So then we had to take panels off the side of the trailer, the radar unit, rigged up some shear legs, backed the Jeep around, and managed, by brute force and a little ignorance, to get the old alternator disconnected and put onto the back of the Jeep across. It looked like two old doors that we found on this farm site that we were parked. All was securely lashed down. There was only room for the driver and one other. And so the driver was the Royal Marine Sergeant, and the officer, because of the special nature and the contact that he'd made, he decided that he would go, Lieutenant Commander, he would go with the Jeep. They drove to Devonport Dockyard, got the defective unit offloaded. The new alternator was put on the Jeep, lashed down, and they came back. By the same way, we managed to get it off the Jeep, back into the new unit, into the cabin, connected up, and replaced the side panels, which incidentally I'd cut an aperture to make up and got a spare Ventaxia fan from the stores wagon, so I could have some form of external venting of the radar cabin. The new machine ran a little warm, but not as bad as what the other one. And so by Saturday night, and finishing off on Sunday, we managed to get the station fully operational for the start of the exercise castanets on the Monday morning. This was a 10-day exercise of convoy reporting and co-radar on the French site on the French coast. They were reporting also. Our reporting was done by landline to a headquarters at Plymouth. Glad to say that the equipment ran very well. We had no problems, and the exercise, well, we achieved 100% reportability. In actual fact, we got a little thank you from Plymouth for very excellent results, far better than what they expected. After the exercise had finished, we had to unpack, unload, to pitch the decamp the tents and all the rest of it, and went over, went a weary way back to Fort Southwark. I returned to Collingwood. In the meantime, the lieutenant commander, I believe so, I think I mentioned it, I think it was Carpenter, he said, look, the Earl's Court radio show is coming up, and we've got a very ambitious stand at the radio show this year. We're going to have a twin Bofors controlled by a tacky director. We're going to have several mock-ups. We've got the mock-up of a submarine's radio and radar office. Would you like to be the petty officer radio electrician in charge? I am the officer in charge. Would you like to be the petty officer radio electrician? And I thought, yes, why not? I'll be very near home. I'll be able to go home at night times. So I jumped at the opportunity. But the first thing to do was to remove parts of the submarine radar that we had at Collingwood for instructional purposes, dismantle that so that we could remount it at Earl's Court. And when the due date for the Earl's Court radio show, all our equipment, all the stands, the parts of the Navy stands were made up in the dockyard to house our equipment. We were showing various features. And part was put up by the contractors. It was rather strange that my brother, Lawrence, who worked for GEC, had been working with GEC on three-dimensional, 3D stereophonic sound. In actual fact, the 1952 Earl's Court radio show was the first time that stereophonic sound had been demonstrated in this country, openly to the public. And he was the technician working on that. So there were two Lesters at the 1952 Earl's Court radio show. It was just after that he left GEC to go to Canada, where he's lived ever since. But when the radio show had finished, our stand had a tremendous success. I had to do a write-up on one of our displays, which showed the effect of feedback on and damping on a velodyne circuit, and I had to write that up and do circuit diagrams for a group of Dutch naval officers who were very intrigued with it and wanted to use it at their electrical school. After return to Collingwood, after the radio show, I went back on to maintenance and instructional duties, and I was sent for almost immediately and said, you must go to Flowerdown WT station, which was near Winchester, and learn about radio teletype, or get up to date with it. When I got to Flowerdown, I was met there by a boffin from Admiralty. He said, oh yes, he said, we are trying to experiment with a new system on radio teletype instead of using one frequency, where you have the marks and spaces, which is subject to interference, we are going to use frequency shift keying. And so the marks on one side, on one frequency, the spaces on the other, and with the unit to decode it so that we can get a more positive signal onto the teleprinters, radio teleprinters. He said, we're also going to try to use this to see if we can use Hellscriber. This is like a ticker tape type machine, and we're going to try that. The problem, the thing is that we are going to go on HMS Vanguard, the battleship, and we're going to go on her winter cruise up to the Arctic with this equipment on board to try out and to try trials, the comparison trials between the RTP, radio teleprinter, and Hellscriber. The object being that in future that we're going to have try to have unattended area broadcast signals. In other words, they can sit there and just let the teleprinter print them out and not have an operator receive them. Also, they could get, by going at 60 words a minute or 66 words per minute, which is the speed of a teleprinter if you can really get it going properly, is far more than the 30 words per minute which has been exercised by normal receiving the area broadcast on communication typewriters. So after a few days at Flower Down, we had the equipment sent ahead, and we travel up, this Abdi Boffin and I, up to Inverness, and eventually we joined HMS Vanguard. The Vanguard, when in the about 1946, did a South African cruise with King George V, Queen Elizabeth, and the princesses on board to South Africa, a state visit. And we took over the press office, which still remained in Vanguard. This is 1952. We took over the press office on the port side of the bridge, in the superstructure, and installed our equipment. Got it working. In actual fact, I was so busy I didn't even know that we'd sailed. But we did. And we gradually went up to the Arctic cruise. There were other trials taking place to do with more of an Arctic nature and survival nature. But our main problem was keeping this equipment tuned in correctly, particularly when we had the Aurora Borealis, which causes terrific problems to the radio communication. Of the two systems, the teleprinter proved the better. And even when we had very bad atmospherics caused by the northern lights, the teleprinter was given quite good results. The Hellscriber was a bit of a problem, because one of the problems of the Hellscriber is that you've got to match the speed of the helix on the Hellscriber to the speed of the helix of the transmitting station. And any slightest variations in power or anything else which can alter the speed of that motor, or the motor needs a bit of lubrication and running down, can completely upset the reading at the receiving station. So, from our point of view, Hillscribe was a non-starter for receiving area broadcasts. This cruise and exercises took right up until end November, beginning of December. When we arrived back in the UK, I immediately left Vanguard with the Boffin. We went back to Flowerdown, and there we spent nearly 3 weeks analysing all the results that we had taken of the various tests. And then I returned to Collingwood. I arrived there the day before Christmas Eve. The place was completely deserted because everybody was on Christmas leave. They welcomed me with open arms, and I was immediately made such mundane tasks like duty petty officer of the day, guard petty officer. One person was doing all the lot there because the camp was virtually closed down. There was no guard. And there were no prisoners. And when the main leave party returned from their Christmas leave, I went on my belated Christmas leave. I still carried on with my instructional task of fault finding on radars, and then I was informed that I was going to go on a foreign draft. The ship was HMS Morecambe Bay, a Bay class frigate, which is at the Far East, which is going to be my second Far East commission. I was received the draft kit in the April, but unfortunately, due to the impending coronation of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth and also the fleet review that was coming up, there were no troop ship sailings. All the troop ships were utilised in bringing the Commonwealth forces that were taking part in the coronation parade to the UK, and they were actually anchored in Spithead for the fleet review, which took place just after the coronation, I think about 3 or 4 days afterwards. Immediately after the fleet review, I was on draft, and I joined the Dilwara, the troop ship, Southampton. And we sailed. I had tried to get my draft postponed, not cancelled, but postponed, because at that time my wife Eileen was very heavily pregnant with Roger. She's about 8 months pregnant. I was trying to get it delayed until after the birth, because at the birth of my first boy, Arlene had a pretty torrid time. But I was informed by the welfare officer in Royal Naval Barracks that they viewed the pregnancy as a normal bodily function. And I replied to the lady who told me that, she was a Miss somebody or other, that obviously she was speaking from a wealth of experience, and I think that really put the finish on my head, any chance I had to get my drafting deferred. Be that as it may, we sailed on the Dilwara, and on the 18th of June 1953, and my son Roger was born on June the 23rd, 5 days later. I funny enough, I got mixed up with the ship's staff. I was very glad to do so, because I didn't want to be singled out to be duty NCOs and things like that on board a troop ship. Being a senior NCO as a petty officer. And I took charge of the sound reproduction system for all the tombolas and things like that. I recruited an LREM as a leading radio electrician's mate and a radio electrician's mate and to assist. And I just ran the dances and things like that. We passed our time. We stopped at Algiers to refuel. And then we stopped again at Colombo. And we arrived at Singapore. That was the terminal point for the Dilwara. She wasn't going any further than Singapore. So myself and another petty officer electrician, Buck Taylor, who's also going to Morecambe Bay, we were drafted up to HMS Terror, a naval base at Singapore. We were there for 2 or 3 days, then we were drafted to HMS Defender, one of the new Daring class destroyers, one of the new Darings, who had been sent to the Far East for evaluation trials. And she was going from Singapore to Hong Kong. And so we had to take transit on the Defender to go to Hong Kong. The Defender was, as I say, doing evaluation trials, and also she was doing gunnery trials in the tropics. And the chief radio electrician of the Defender said, didn't know anything at all about the 262 radar. Well, the 262 radar is the one that's mounted on the Twin Bofors mounting. And it's called a STAG, STAAG. I think I've mentioned this before. It means synchronized tachymetric anti-aircraft gun. But I said, yes. I said, I've been instructing on it. I'm instructing on fault finding on it. He said, you're just the man. He said, can you get ours working properly? So I, with the STAG mounting comes what's called an RMR, a radar maintenance room, which has a complete set of rack of equipment, which you can set up in situ in the RMR and transpose the units on the actual mounting. This I did, and in the ensuing AA shoot, I'm very pleased to say the STAG worked beautifully. The chief asked me, he said, do you want to stay on board the Daring? The chief electrician said, do you want to stay on board the Daring?
The Daring or the Defender?
The Defender. And I said, no, I said, I've been drafted to the Morecambe Bay and I'll stick with that. And so I joined HMS Morecambe Bay in Hong Kong. This would be the August. She just come off a Korean patrol. And while we were there in Hong Kong, the armistice had just been signed at between the North and South Korea. So Morecambe's Bay, who'd done very, very active work in bombarding and patrolling off Korea during the troubles up there, thought, oh well, we're in for a quiet life. But that was not to be really, because we still had to do patrols. We used to do a Formosa Strait patrol to stop the nationalists and the Americans as well from interfering with British shipping, trading with Red China. We had to go do Korean patrols to stop the infiltration of North Korean agents coming into South Korea. And we used to also go down to Singapore and do bombardments in support of the army in selected areas to help drive the Chinese communists away out into the open in a combined operation between the Navy and the Army. It's rather funny when you think of it that we often used to say when we woke up in the morning, what hat do we wear today? Are we a commie or anti-commie? Because depending where the ship was, at one stage we were bombarding communists in Malaya, we were patrolling Korea against anti-communists, and yet on the Formosa Strait patrol we were on the communist side protecting British shipping from being interfered with by the Americans and the Chinese nationalists. So we say, what hat are we wearing today? But that is a facet of naval life, unfortunately, or fortunately, that they have to adapt to all kinds of changing circumstances. We had a very good captain on the Morecambe Bay. His name was Hamer, Commander Hamer. He was quite an extrovert character, but he made his point to know everybody in the ship, every one of his ship's company, he knew by name. My division officer was the navigating officer, Lieutenant Simon Alistair Cassells. He finished up actually as an admiral and second sea lord. But on the Morecambe Bay, he was lieutenant, and he was the navigating officer, pilot, as they call them. He was also had to do duty as the electrical officer. When I joined the ship, he said, this ship does enjoy the fact that for most of the time it has been 100% operational in all the electronic gear on the ship. That's radio and radar. He said, I like it to be kept that way. The radio electrical staff consisted of an REA named John Maury, myself, and two REMs, one named Petrie and one named Smith. And we were responsible for, well, all the electronics in the ship. Theoretically, the electricians looked after the sonar, but they always used to, when they had an electronic problem on the sonar gear, always used to ask one of us to go and give them a hand. I will say this, that the 100% reliability or the operational capability of the equipment was down to John Maury and my predecessor, a red electrician named Rogers. They had worked very hard to keep it going very well. They'd instituted some sealing process on the junctions, on the aerial connections for the 285 radar, which one of the biggest bugbears was the aerial insulation going down on those sets, and the sets not working very well. But their system maintain that the heritage legislation